Can assure you that what you will observe is a vast wasteland.
To try and channel it.
The
free and uncorrupted communication.
Any good manager always brings a team of people with him that are smarter than they are, and that's what I've done today. Chancellor Mrs. Yang, Dean Moskovich, Chair Blaskovich, and both Sage and University guests, it's my distinct pleasure to be here and to add my welcome to this afternoon and to take part of the launching of the new Sage Center for the Study of Mind. We're about to hear from our three distinguished speakers, all of them experts on studying the human mind from three different perspectives. This center will incorporate the sciences, the social sciences, and the humanities. This enterprise is bold and precipitated by advances in these three broad intellectual areas represented here today. It is interesting to note that the unanswerable questions, that of why the human mind, have now given away to the kind of questions modern knowledge systems can address, namely the what can I know about something and how can I know it. It is not that the why doesn't fascinate us, and perhaps it even compels us to consider the what and how as we stumble forward as a species seeking the truth about the nature of our being. And a society has an added strength when it admits there seems to be currently many answers to the why, provided by the many mythologies and belief systems that offer solutions to the why. So long as we realize these are all competing stories and tolerate that fact, the serious business of what and how about the human mind can go forward. And that is what the Sage Center will be doing. John Barry, in his fascinating book, The Great Influenza of 1918, talks about the huge boost medicine was given by those awful events as it pushed the medical community to start to ask the what and how. More generally, when considering the history of medicine, we can parallel what the task is that we have set ourselves with the Sage Center. Barry notes that big leaps came in medicine when physicians went beyond the passive process of merely making careful observation about disease states and then reasoning about them, and moved on to the active probing of the disease in question. This really didn't start until Galen began dissecting animals and caring for the wounded gladiators, where one could look deeply into the wounds, because at the time, cadaver dissection was not allowed. The Hippocratic Galenic tradition of observing and reasoning, which held sway for 2,500 years, nonetheless was gradually challenged as insufficient. Vesalius dissected human corpses and claimed Galen was mostly wrong. Vesalius was sentenced to death for this heresy. Today, one could just count on having a funding cycle skipped for such insubordination. But it was in the 1800s when Pasteur and other Europeans that the experimental side of medicine began to take hold. It was flourishing in Europe and in particular in Germany before the medical revolution occurred in the United States. And that revolution came in 1873 when Johns Hopkins died and left a $3.5 million to launch the entire new University of Johns Hopkins. The new school hired to run it the new president of the University of California, who had had a fight with the legislature and decided to leave town. He brought the great Thomas Huxley to the United States to help, and the rest is history. What propelled medicine after that groundbreaking work was the influenza epidemic in 1918, and resulted in the great medicine that we have today. So here we are launching with our launching gift with the same charge. We can now probe the study of the human mind because of recent technological advances. We no longer have to simply observe behavior and think about what it might mean. We can probe, dissect, and make predictions, and we're now ready to study the largest enigma on Earth. So, as it was only 100 years ago when serious medical research was launched, look what we now have. I would like to be back here in 100 years to see what the 100 years of work on the mind will produce. Let me introduce our speakers, Mark Raichel from Washington University, perhaps the leading brain imaging scientist in the world today, will be telling us about the how. Networks of specific mental processes are being unearthed with these new technology. Augmenting the empirical work of thousands of modern brain scientists, we have seen how modern philosophers trained in study of the human mind now lend their rigorous logical tools to help basic scientists with the meaning of their results. Pat Churchland has led this from UCSD and is perhaps the first modern philosopher to see the need and opportunity and leads the world in providing the bridge work between the probative data and logic. And finally, we have come to realize that a major aspect of the human mind deals with social process about how thinking about others consumes more of our thoughts than thinking about our personal awareness. Marjan Banaji from Harvard University has led the way on this exciting new area in the study of mind. So the plan is to begin with Dr. Raichel, then Dr. Churchin, and then Dr. Banaji. So, Mark.
I'm actually quite honored to be here today to share this wonderful event with friends of mine, particularly Mike Gazzaniga, who I've known for many, many years, and Jim Blaskovich as well, and with all of you. I'm also honored to be the representative of those who do work in cognitive neuroscience, and especially in the whole world of brain imaging, which has developed in ways that I never possibly could have imagined. So let me tell you a little bit about where we are today and maybe where we will be going. I want to just comment a little bit about the antecedents to this, very little actually. The history of this is a wonderful story that goes back better than a century, but we don't have a century tonight, so I'll leave most of that out. And also to talk about a bit about the scope of the enterprise and then to try to put it, if you will, into a bit of perspective here for you. The antecedents that are probably most germane at the present time relate to the introduction of imaging. And as many of you know, imaging as we now understand it was introduced as X-ray computed tomography in 1972 by Godfrey Hounsfield, and it not only revolutionized the way medicine is practiced, but it revolutionized the way we think about obtaining images from the human body. So probably most of you who are in this room are familiar with the medical implications of that discovery or that invention, but maybe fewer of you are aware of the fact that this invention then propelled scientists to develop what is called positron emission tomography, which allowed us for the first time to look at the function of the brain and other organs of the body. And the brain was a major target of this work from the very, very beginning. So whereas this is a map of anatomy, this is actually a map of function characterized in terms of how much energy the brain is using. So dark areas are working harder and lighter areas are working less hard. But that shortly thereafter was followed by magnetic resonance imaging. And again, many of you have encountered this technique as a regular medical diagnostic tool, but it has an enormous potential actually to look at the function, particularly of the brain, and I will comment about that as I move along. So in a period of about 10 years or so, we suddenly had laid on our lap amazing tools to look within the brain, and particularly the normal human brain, and see how it works. And it's based on a deceptively simple observation, which is that when the brain changes its activity locally, say, for example, when you look at this checkerboard as compared to this little crosshair, areas in the visual cortex become more active because the blood flow there goes up. And we've known this for better than 100 years, and I'm embarrassed to say we still don't know precisely why that happens. But it's an enormously useful observation so that we can compare when you look at a stimulus like that to when you don't, and subtract and look at the difference. So most of the images that you look at in this field today, well, the sophistication surrounding exactly how that was obtained are largely based on that very simple observation. Now, that wasn't, in my estimation, really enough here. We had known this, and I speak we generally, the community of scientists had known about these kinds of observations for a very long time, actually going back into the 1940s. And I'd often ask myself the question, why was it that this simple approach and idea, imaging aside, had not been adopted more any earlier than it had? And I think it was because it's not only a matter of looking at how the brain does something in terms of its change in its energy or the change in what neurons are doing, but it is also important to understand what the behavior is that is causing that to change. And the important step forward here, which has become known as cognitive neuroscience, arose as a result of the joining of forces of two very important fields. This diagram comes from a lecture by Bruce Alberts given a number of years ago at the National Academy of Sciences as his presidential address, and I've modified it slightly, and I include neuroscience on your left and social sciences on your right. And with any field, you see this development and growth of these areas and branching and subspecialization. But as he pointed out, it is when areas from one field join forces with areas from another field that you get what are very important advances. And this is precisely what happened here when cognitive psychology and systems neuroscience joined forces in what in a field that Mike Gazzaniga coined cognitive neuroscience. And you can almost say the rest was history. And we went from those very simple observations of a lighting up of visual cortex when you turned a light on to elaborate demonstrations of changes in brain function in many areas related to function, different kinds of functions here in the processing of words. But the range of things now covers pretty much the range of all human behaviors. So I think the joining of means by which we can look at behavior in combination with these tools was really important. Now, the scope of the enterprise could be assessed in many different ways, and in the interest of time, I've chosen to do it this way. I've returned to the slide you just saw, which is imaging involving a variety of technologies now and this very important relationship here, but in one direction that I think is very heartening in this whole enterprise, and that is that it isn't just at this level that people studying the cellular behavior of the brain are now very interested in the relationship between what we can see in humans and what people who put electrodes in the brain can determine. This is some electrophysiology from a group in Germany where they measured the imaging results and they measured the actual cellular behavior. And the insights that we're getting from that are tremendously important. And it's actually gone down to the level of deciding what cells are doing and why it costs so much and why it does it in particular ways that make that imaging signal apparent to us. And again, the details for today are not so important, but the fact that we're having these multidisciplinary levels where nobody is claiming to have a corner on truth here. Nobody has got the magic tool here, but the dialogue that will result from this, I think, will be enormously important. And it extends all the way to genetics. So from all of these different levels, there are interfaces to stuff occurring at the top and in the other direction. But it is not just, if you will, a downward trajectory. We now have social neuroscience, we have neuroeconomics, and we even have neuromarketing, and I was surprised to find out recently that a group has actually patented the idea of neuromarketing. Heaven help us. So we then have this incredible plethora appearing in many journals, in thousands of articles, virtually impossible now to keep up with, of maps of the brain. And they're not only in journals, they're in Time Magazine and Newsweek and you name it, it's everywhere. I would like to just offer a bit of perspective on what's going on here. It is not to devalue that aspect of this, but to give you a sense that there is a whole lot more to come on this story and exactly where it's going to come from. And I take as a point of departure here the world of astronomy and cosmology. You're looking at an image from the Hubble telescope here. It's something you could obtain on the web. And when you look at this, you will find that there are areas within that array of the heavens that some particular scientist has taken an interest in. And naturally, they can blow it up and put arrows on it and colors, and just like we do in cognitive neuroscience. But for those who work in this area, and there may be some of you who are familiar with this or who actually do that in this room, you realize there's a matter of dark energy here. And that is that most of what is out there is not visible in looking at it this way and remains a mysterious presence. And I would like to suggest that we have a similar problem in the brain. So that when we look at images like this, I think it's a fair question to ask ourselves, is this the whole story? And let me try to enlarge upon that slightly. And that is that this little thing in your head is only 2% of the body's weight, and yet it is consuming 20% of all of the energy that your body consumes. So it's a very expensive gadget to run. And 80% of that is related to its function. Now, you might then ask, well, maybe these little fellows here are ongoing, and that's really what's so costly. And I would like to disabuse you of that notion by showing you this simple demonstration. Here are images of the brain from up, and each row, these are all the same people, and each row is a different task. So that from images such as this, you could have obtained the pictures of these differences that I've been showing you. And I defy anybody in this audience to point out what the differences are here. So let me help you. Eyes closed, eyes open, viewing words, and so forth. Now, many of you aren't familiar with that paradigm, but that's a very standard sort of thing to manipulate. So here they had their eyes closed, their eyes open, and you look in here, and I, again, defy you knowing that information, where are the differences? So I'll put them up for you. And there they are, and this is typical, and we have high confidence those differences are there. The point to make here is that they're exceedingly small as compared to the overall cost of running this machine. You're now asking the question of the brain, how do you decide what it's doing when you can't observe anything of what it's doing? It's just laying there. So, you know, as my friends say, usually what we do is the guy on the white coat goes up and asks you to do something, and then we measure what you do, and we look at what the brain's doing. But the big question on the table now is, what is it doing when that is not ongoing? And I would just give you a sense of the clues that emerge in work that's ongoing. The first clue we had was that anytime you engage in doing something, you not only increase activity in certain parts of the brain, but you rather routinely decrease activity, suggesting that we begin to get an imprint of what the brain's doing when you're not directly engaged in a task. And such things as this is a very standard image that depicts that kind of a change in the brain. And the other thing is that the signals that we look at, and this is true of signals in science in general, are very noisy. So if you look at a brain signal from an imaging device, you can see it go up and down in the visual areas when you open and close your eyes. But you notice that that's a very wiggly signal. And it turns out that signal contains enormous amounts of information about what the brain is doing. And if you just look at that signal, and you put a region over the motor cortex of the brain and not do anything, you're just laying there, what you find is that not only the area that you're monitoring, but the whole motor system is sitting there operationally wired up, connected, and working. So the organization, and you can then proceed to march through areas of the brain like the visual cortex, and the details here are really fun to talk about, but I won't. And you can even come down to that mysterious group of areas that decrease their activity. And what begins as you march around the brain is that all of these things that we have been causing to reveal themselves by activities appear to be present and organized when you're just laying there. 1 minute, the man said. And what we find out is, as well, that there are interesting relationships between areas in that system that emerge in such maps. And again, the details here are probably less important at the moment, but to point out to you that these incredible maps that come out of this are, again, when you're just laying there doing nothing. What this begins to tell us is that a large part of what your brain is doing is all intrinsic. The majority of what it's doing is intrinsic. And the impact of the stuff you see in the world around you is surprisingly little relative to what it's doing. So how might we just think about it in my closing comments here? William James, who some of you know, has a wise thing to say about just everything we can consider, and he said it all in 1890 or thereabouts. He said, enough has been said to prove the general law of perception, which is this, that whilst part of what we perceive comes through our senses from the object before us, another part, and it may be the larger part, always comes out of our own head. And I think that was very profound. For those of you interested in a recent view of how to think about this, it might well fall under a metaphor that I like a lot. That is, the brain is in the prediction guessing business, and this falls into the category of what's called Bayesian inference, so that it can predict. And I may be too bold, but I'll say that memory may be an element of the priors of Bayesian inference, for those of you who follow this. What do we mean by this? And I'll almost stop with that, but look at this piece of writing up there. My son-in-law, who's an airline pilot, handed it to me a few months ago. And if you take a moment, you realize you can read that. Now ask yourself the question, why is it you can read that? And I would suggest it's your Bayesian priors at work. And you come into this world with your Bayesian priors in operation. This is from Andy Meltzoff at 4 hours of life. So I'll skip this and point out that when we think about the brain, it's very easy from our perspective to view it a bit like an iceberg. We can paint it red, we can talk about it, we can give it names and functions, but we've got to be aware of the fact that it is an iceberg and most of it is below the water. Thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure to be here and a great honor to be here for the opening of the Sage Center. If the past is anything to go by, basically whatever project Mike Gazzaniga handles turns out to be legendary, and I rather suspect that will be the case for this center as well. Given my 15 minutes, I'm going to begin by making some fairly broad comments about how I see the field of philosophy, or shall I say neurophilosophy, the intersection of issues in traditional philosophy and developments in neuroscience. And then I want to get a little bit more specific and to raise some specific problems, mainly within the field of what I'm going to call neuroethics. So I see that there are essentially two growth areas. One, neuroepistemology, which really has to do with how it is that this 3 pounds of meat in our heads can create a model of the external world. More specifically, how it can create a model of the causal structure of that external world. The idea that there are wasps that sting, or that there are trees that are particularly fruitful, or that there are friends that are trustful. How is it that a brain can understand by interacting with the world something about the nature of that world? And the other field that is really a growth area now has to do with ethics and how it is that what we're understanding about the nature of the brain within the larger context, really, of evolutionary biology, how that can tell us something about the nature of ethics itself. Oops. Which is the forward? Left? It seems like it's telling me to end show. All right, somebody do something. Oh, you want that one? Okay, now what? Okay. So within the larger field of neuroethics, I think there are two general domains that we can talk about. One having to do with applications, that is how it is that results in neuroscience are going to impinge upon particular aspects of our lives, sometimes raising ethical questions about what's appropriate to do, what's best for all of us in the long haul to do. But the other one, and the one that in a certain sense is perhaps more philosophical, but the one that really tugs most deeply at my own interests, has to do with how we might understand the nature of ethical behavior itself in neurobiological terms. But let me say a little bit first about applications, because they are, of course, extremely important. Apart from the obvious applications within the medical domain, there are, I think, others that are extremely important. The medical ones, I don't mean to understress. I think that the medical advances will be extraordinarily important, especially for diseases such as schizophrenia, Alzheimer's disease, multiple sclerosis, and the various childhood neurological disorders. But I haven't even really touched on the vast, vast number of neurological disorders that I think we will be able to have an impact on as a result of basic understanding of how the brain works. But there are other applications that have a kind of wider social impact, even for those people who are not directly affected by a medical intervention. One concerns moderation of intolerance of biological abnormalities. And I think we've already seen some of this within my own lifetime. For example, people with Tourette's and also people with Alzheimer's, I think, are treated in a really rather different way now than they were in my own childhood. Almost certainly, we will be able to develop more realistic and more effective ways of treating drug addiction, which is an enormous social problem. There may also be an attitudinal change so that we will be less interested in seeing drug addiction as a failure of character or a lack of willpower, and able to see it rather in terms of something where we can have a medical intervention which will allow that person to be the person he really is. I also think that it's quite possible that it will allow us to have a much deeper and richer understanding of this thing that we call self-control, which is real. And it's real in the sense that we see it not only in ourselves, us as humans, but also in other animals. But we would like to know, what is it that goes on in the brain as a child develops self-control? What are failures of self-control? What is it about the reward system that's able to set priorities within the short term and the long term, such that this thing that is so important, self-control, can be manifest? Number four touches on something that Mike Gazzaniga mentioned in the context of talking about Galen, And it is a very practical, but I think terribly important thing, and that is that as people have a greater appreciation of themselves as bodies with brains, albeit wonderful, beautiful, marvelous machines, but not souls, they will be more willing to donate their bodies after death, so that medical students can actually have human bodies and human brains to learn from. Finally, of course, I think we will be able to use knowledge to enhance ourselves. And don't think immediately of cosmetic kinds of interventions, but there are other possibilities. For example, we know now, a discovery made within the last 5 years, that even in the adult human, new neurons are made. But the other thing that's so intriguing about this, or at least we know this from mouse studies, is that to the degree that the mouse really exercises, more of those new neurons migrate into the cortex and are maintained and set up housekeeping. And there's real reason to think that there is a strong correlation between maintenance of the health of the hippocampus and related cortical structures and exercise. But now let me turn to what I think is, in a certain sense, the deeper issue, although it's an issue also that has social implications. How might we understand the nature of ethics itself, this civil behavior that we engage in, such that although there are some murders, there are many fewer than you might expect? Part of then what I think we want to understand is the neurobiological basis for moral behavior in general, for the capacity of humans to cooperate, to reciprocate, to share, to defend one another, and to care for one another. Where does that come from in terms of genes and in terms of the wiring that the genes make possible and in terms of the gene wiring interactions that culture makes possible? We are beginning to understand a little bit about the neurobiology of decisions and choices. And one of the things that seems moderately clear at this point is that the brain is a causal machine. And if the mind is what the brain does, then the brain's decisions and choices, the brain's thoughts and desires, are the products of antecedent causes. This means that all of our behavior is caused. I think that within that domain of understanding, there is still a place for distinguishing between what it is for someone to not be responsible because, for example, insane or involuntarily intoxicated, or perhaps because lacking the capacity for self-control, and what it is to be responsible. Those lines, I think, we can draw within the framework of understanding that the brain is a causal machine. But that's a longer story. And finally, I think we can begin to address what it is for a brain to have a sense of self, a sense that this is my body, that I am a person, that I can reflect on my own capacities. But in some sense, and I think Mike Gazzaniga actually understood this very clearly many years ago as a result of working on split brain patients, self-representation is a construct of the brain. There isn't literally in the brain a thing that is the self. It's the way the brain interprets a whole lot of what's going on in that spontaneous activity that Mark Raichel talks about. And when we understand that, I think that will give us a very deeper and richer understanding of what it is to be a self and to have a self. I want to say a little bit about the traditional approach to morality before I say a bit about the neurobiological approach. Traditionally, at least, this is true within Western culture. It is not true within much of Eastern culture. Our approach has been to think that morality must rest on laws. And presumably, what an anthropologist would tell us is that what this is an extrapolation from the sort of local conventions to morality as a whole. But the problem with this view, at least one of the problems, has always been what could possibly be the source of such laws? They weren't supposed to come up in that order. The traditional answer that many people, at least in Western cultures, are very fond of is to say that religion is the source of morality. Religion provides the framework for moral laws, and it does so by way of divine intervention. To put it in crudely, God pronounces what the laws are. And I think in many ways it's in a very attractive notion. But as my students are fond of saying, it's just too bad that Socrates kicked the crap out of it about 2,000 years ago. And the argument actually is very interesting. Socrates was in prison about to die for asking questions that were impolitic. In the course of waiting for death, he had discussions, amongst others, Euthyphro, who was himself a priest. So Socrates says, "So Euthyphro, you're a wise man, tell me, what is justice?" And Euthyphro, never one to shy away, said, "Oh, well, I can easily answer that. What's justice? What God says is just." And here was Socrates' answer, and this is what motivated my student to be his harsh comment. Socrates said, "Look, do you mean that it's right because God says it's right? In other words, saying it's right makes it right. Oh, no, Senator Rutherford. I mean, you realize that, you know, that was a ludicrous way to go. Because, I mean, suppose God said, take your firstborn, boil them up, and feed them to the dogs. That would be right just because he said it was right. That wouldn't work. So, no, said Euthyphro. The only other option, says Socrates, is that God says it's right because it is right. Well, if that's so, why does God say that that's right? And if there's a reason, then we can know it too. And that's really one of the reasons why it's never worked. Now, of course, the other reason why this answer has not worked is because there are different ways of looking at what the laws are. Reason was hoped to be the answer so that you could do it independently of religion. That didn't work very well either. Mike says, I got 2 minutes, so I'm going to hustle. What we really want to know is there something about the nature of who we are, of our biology? And there is where I think the answer ultimately is. That our biological evolution determines that we are social organisms, that we evolved in such a way that the social virtues, the civic virtues of cooperation, reciprocity, mutual defense, triumphed over the uncivil virtues. And so long as an animal is able to track who is cooperative, who is decent, and animals are able to shun those who aren't. And we see this not only in the human communities, but amongst wolves, bats, and just about any social organism that there is. That's an evolutionarily stable strategy. And what you will see is that a population dominated by those with civil virtues will emerge. Trustworthiness then turns out to be a value, a commodity, because you do better for your own genes in a social context. You get the benefits of the sociability and you pay a price, but the price is small relative to the benefits. Untrustworthiness is a cost because you don't get the benefits of the social group. Finally, and this is going to touch both on the matter of neuroepistemology and also on our next speaker. Categories have a prototype organization. And one of the things we learn about the cultural part of this story is that children learn stereotypes of the honest person or the stupid thing to do or the reckless thing to do or what it is to be courageous. We teach them via stories such as Chicken Little and the Little Engine That Could, so that they have a stereotype of the virtues, where that stereotype then, through Bayesian mechanisms, gets modified over time. And I won't say anything now, because I've run out of time, about the self, but the story of neuroethics is obviously also going to need to mesh, if it's going to be complete, with a story about the self. Final three questions just to leave you with. For the judicial system to function, must we act as if the self creates decisions free of all causes? I actually don't think so. Second, if people in general understand that ethics is really rooted in neurobiology and social negotiation, will there be a breakdown of the social order? I don't think so. Finally, if people understand that the self is a brain construction, will they fall apart? And that's something my students ask. I don't think so. Thank you.
Thank you for having me here. I am delighted. I have been an admirer of this psychology department and related areas at UCSB for many, many years. Jim Blaskovich and his colleagues in social psychology have done work that has defined this field, and it is an absolute pleasure for me to be here and participate in this wonderful occasion. So given the occasion of this extraordinary gift to this university and to my science, I'm going to hope that I'll be permitted a little bit of chauvinism. The argument that I'm going to make is that if we want to understand us, let me see if I can move this. If we want to understand us, we're going to have to understand the mind. To understand the mind, we know that there are at least two sources of very important information that have to be taken into account. The thing that my colleagues have talked about, this 2 to 3 pound thing between the ears, and then what another colleague of mine called everything that lies on the sunny side of the epidermis. Okay, so these are the two sources of information that we are going to have to deal with. And then what are the processes that we're going to be interested in? I think to understand our minds, we're going to have to understand where we've come from as a species. That's determined in some sense the structure of the brain, the functions that it serves, the architecture of our cognition, and so on. But likewise, there's another very important input into what our minds are and therefore what we are, and that has to do with the role of experience, starting, as Mark showed us, from the moment of birth and onwards. Okay, the baby that imitates those expressions comes ready with some mechanism to learn. But then who it sticks its tongue out at is something that it's going to learn a little bit later. Okay, has the mechanism, but who to stick it out to is going to be learned later. And finally, and this is the kind of work that people like myself have been interested in, we're interested not just in the evolutionary history and our long histories as individuals in particular cultures, but in what immediate situations can do. Okay? And this is, in some ways, really stunning, because why should it matter? Okay? Whether you're sitting in this room or one that looks very different, why should it matter who sits next to you when you're taking a test, or whether you were just reminded that you were black or white or female or male? And yet one of the things that we do know from this field in which I do my work is that the immediate situation has a power all of its own, and one that we constantly underestimate in understanding how the mind works. Many of you know me to have relied on this illusion to sort of show many, many different things about how the mind works. I don't know if you can actually see much of it here. Yes, you can. So let me see if I can. The argument I'm going to make very briefly is that these two tables, okay, have an identical surface area. That is to say, if I were to take the table on the left and turn it around and place it on the table on the right, the two surfaces would fit identically. Okay? How many of you are willing to take a bet that that's not the case? Okay. All right. You'll buy me a drink after this session. Okay. All right. So it turns out that I don't have the overhead projector to show this to you, but I'm going to first of all just take away the legs. Whoops. This is not doing it. I think it's not. I think we've moved machines. So this only works on my PC and apparently is not transferring right. Take my word for it. Okay. I don't know if you can see this. Can you see? Can you see this from there? Okay. All right. Let me see if I can do it. It fits. Ooh, is the right answer. This is the highlight of my 15 minutes, so feel free to clap. Okay. All right. This is a remarkable illusion. Sorry you can't get to see it better, but the point is that two things can look extremely different to us, but if we understood our evolutionary history, why we evolved the kinds of brains that we did, our experience, knowing about perspective, that things that lie parallel to the line of vision need to have something done to them, and compared to things that lie perpendicular to the line of vision, okay? Our retina actually has the right answer. It knows that these two parallelograms are identical. But in the sending of this information to the brain and the brain's interpretation of it and the involvement of our minds in making sense of it, an answer comes back rapidly, so that you perceive these two to be quite different, okay? Without asking your permission, the mind has done a bunch of work that tells you that these two are intrinsically, inherently different when in fact they're not. Okay? One of the things that the mind sciences can teach us a lot about is how these errors get made, why they get made. As Mark said, we're a Bayesian, the brain is a Bayesian machine, and I think that the brain knows to do certain things because in many cases it makes sense to do it that way. But there are very important occasions in which we fall apart. is that when we think about troubling ethical questions, what do you do in a situation like the one that Terry Schiavo created, okay, for us to contemplate? Is this, you know, Bill Frist said, you look at her and you know that there's life there in her. There are others who thought very, very differently. What is it that makes up a mind like Osama bin Laden? What is it that leads the president of my university to look at the correlation between gender and mathematics and science as represented in our worlds and to argue from that, that this must mean that women are not as capable of being in mathematics and science and so on? So one of the things the mind sciences can do is not only provide the evidence that actually can lead us to point to one answer as being more likely to be the correct answer than the other. It can help us understand these very minds that are thinking the kinds of thoughts that I just described to you. So one of the things that we've been interested in, and I'm going to just describe to you just a very few studies that might point in the direction of this argument I've been making, that to understand who we are, we're going to have to understand our evolutionary history, we're going to have to understand our history as individuals across some period of time, and then these immediate situations. So I'll give you an example of a study that we recently did and published this past summer, in which we were interested in looking at what is it that happens in a very basic system, a learning system that is involved in learning how to associate very simple things. So most of you know about classical conditioning or Pavlovian conditioning that you learned about in high school. If I were to take a neutral object like this and associate it, okay, in some way to a negative thing, like you feel a little bit of a buzz on your finger every time I pull this up, you're going to very quickly learn to make that association. And now, as soon as this shows up, your body is going to respond physiologically in a way that will indicate to us that you've learned this kind of what we might call a fear association. Liz Phelps at NYU and I took this idea and decided to look at the effects of this on how it is that we might learn to fear members of groups that are either very similar to us or very dissimilar to us. Okay? And again, the idea here is to look at a machine that comes ready to learn in a certain way and then look at how our culture teaches us particular kinds of associations. So we did a very simple test. White and black students at NYU were in this study in which they saw faces that were either black or white. That is to say, they were faces with features that were either Afrocentric or Eurocentric. And to two of these faces, one black and one white, they got a little bit of a buzz on their finger whenever they saw them. Okay? This is ethically actually possible. Human subjects committees allow us to do this kind of work because the person has to decide how much of a buzz they're willing to tolerate. Okay? And we tell them, tolerate something that makes you uncomfortable but is not painful. So what we get is a natural physiological reaction such that whenever these faces show up, the black and white one, you start to secrete more sweat on your palms and our little electrodes detect that. There are other faces that are very similar in every way, but to which there is no buzz attached. And when they show up, you show no reaction. So we know that people have learned this particular kind of reaction. Okay? The interesting question is what happens when you stop buzzing in response to what you've learned? Okay? Don't worry about them. Just listen to me. Okay. All right. The important thing is what happens when you now no longer are providing this negative piece of information, which is to say the buzz on the finger. What's going to happen now? What we're interested in looking at how quickly we begin to forget the fear that we might have learned to both of these faces. And what we're discovering is that fear is lost a whole lot more quickly to faces that are members of our own group. So whites show a much more rapid fear reaction sort of decrease, okay, to white faces that were previously shocked. And African Americans show the same but opposite effect. They lose fear to members of their own group a whole lot quickly. So what do we know from all of this? We know, and we're arguing, that because these kinds of results have been seen with many other species, we think we can create them in different ways, not using buzzers and shocks, but with very young children. What we have been arguing is that we come ready in some way to know that this is a thing that's similar to me, different from me, and as Arne Orman, who wrote a commentary on our work, said, you know, this might explain why it is the same act of terrorism when performed by a member of our own group versus a member of another group will end up creating a decrease in fear over time at very different rates, okay? But here's the kicker, and this is the part that I'm interested in sort of pushing as the mind sciences join more and more closely with the social sciences. It's the idea of contact. And so we look to see, there were always in our studies a small group of people, both black and white, who were equal in losing their fear to members of the outgroup. So who were they? We had dozens and dozens of questions, and nothing seemed to predict except one, and that was whether you were somebody who had had romantic involvement with members of the other group. So if you were white and you had a relationship with somebody who was black, okay, even if you weren't happy with that relationship anymore, okay, you still showed no extra fear to members of that out-group than to members of the in-group. Okay? This is what experience does. This is what immediate situations might do. And I have a few slides that I actually can't really tell you the data on without showing you the slides. So I'm going to just continue to mutter on and argue that in very much the same way as the older sciences have had to think about developing technologies that would help us try to solve a problem. And I'll think here about Galileo, as both of my colleagues have mentioned something related. And in the past, especially Mark, when he mentioned astronomy, you know, it takes a long, long time in science to go from the development of the very first little pieces of a technology to getting to the stage where one can have something like a center of this kind. You know, it was in the 12th century that Bacon took a piece of, you know, a glass and said, wow, I can create something through which the blind can see, because he had created the first most rudimentary pair of spectacles, okay? And it took 4 centuries after that, okay, for the son of a Dutch artisan to take 2 pieces of glass and put them in a particular configuration, turn them outward, and say, my God, I can see forever, okay? And it took Galileo, who said, you know, I think that this can do more than be something that children run around the streets playing with. We'll turn it to the stars, and we'll see something there that will give us a message back that we are not who we think we are, okay? I think that for 2,000 years, the older sciences have been at this. They've developed technology after technology, so the Hubble telescope is hardly anything that looks the same. And I'm going to argue that centers like this, coming as early as they do in the development of the mind science, are going to help us build the equivalents of these telescopes, except that these are telescopes that we're going to turn inward to look at the way in which we may not be the people that we think that we might be. In many, many lines of work that I can sort of review for you with or without slides, one of the things that we're coming to see is that our actions, our thoughts, our feelings, our beliefs are way out of line with who we think we are. So the vast majority of the work that I have been involved in myself is work to demonstrate that we can hold a view of ourselves in some very abstract fashion that says, I am a good human being. And on the other hand, we can show that each of us, with that abstract and in some ways very true view of ourselves, can perform actions and behaviors that are quite out of line with the way in which we think of ourselves. So I'm just going to bring this to a conclusion by saying, when you have a center like this one of the things that hopefully you will be able to do is to have in it people who will do everything from single-cell recordings of individual neurons to people who will study how entire societies put themselves together and march forward or backward. Okay? And that's going to be a very difficult task to even to imagine. How is it that the same science or the same group of people can tackle problems that range in this way? And I will again just say that science has been there before, and we do have models. A countryman of mine, Subramaniam Chandrasekhar, after whom the space orbit Chandra is named, said in the 1930s something that people at the time found very hard to believe. He said, look at the mechanics of this little thing, an electron, and I'm going to argue that the way it works is exactly the same. This is the most microscopic of phenomena at the time. And he said the way it works is telling us something about the exact way in which the most macroscopic of phenomena we know of work, and that is black holes. Okay? And at the time, he was denounced. His advisor stood up in public and said he was wrong, and he went into hiding and wrote lots of textbooks in astrophysics. And then 50 years later, after many of his students had won Nobel Prizes themselves, he was given a prize for that work, that said that the workings, not that this forms an analogy or a metaphor for the other, but that exactly the way in which this little system works tells us about how this massive system works. And I'm going to say that the task before us is very much the same, that we might discover that these little neurons and what goes on in our heads say an awful lot about the way in which our societies are organized as well. And I think I'm going to stop there and take questions. Thank you.